Okay, we're gonna begin again. Thank you all for staying with us. As Ansem mentioned, I'm gonna kind of do a bit of a teaser of a talk that I was thinking to do. So it's just gonna be like three very broad strokes, and then I'm gonna move into an introduction of Christian Krawagner, who will be our final speaker for the conference. So I think it was about a year ago, and we were still in the very early stages of not yet knowing exactly what we were doing. And it was probably because George Michael had just died that his song Freedom came to mind. And of course, lyrics don't have to all add up and make sense, but these two lines that are part of the climb, the section that precedes the chorus, somehow at that moment felt potent for a line of thought. And I'm not gonna sing for you, Claire was gonna dance, but all we gotta do now is take these lies and make them true somehow. The question of, I mean, one of the first questions that I think I jotted down in a notebook was, what is the difference or what is the border between a secret and a lie? If the CCF was a project of covert propaganda, where is that border? Francis Donna Saunders mentions George F. Keenan in relation to the notion of the necessary lie. We heard his name a lot today, yesterday as well, but in a speech at the National War College in December 1947, it was Keenan who introduced the concept of the necessary lie as a vital constituent of American post-war diplomacy. The communists, he said, I'm quoting Saunders, had won a strong position in Europe, so immensely superior to our own, now I'm quoting him, through unabashed and skillful use of lies. They have fought us with unreality, with irrationalism. Can we combat this unreality successfully? With rationalism, with truth, with honest, well-meant economic assistance? He asked. Answer, no. America needed to embrace a new era of covert warfare to advance her democratic objectives against Soviet deceit. And so came the kind of legal constitution of the necessary lie as foreign policy. Broad strokes, I'm gonna skip, and this is something that Christian maybe knows even much more of. But another book that was somehow, another figure, and then the book, we were working with a number of kind of characters while we were thinking through the many angles and aspects of this story. And one of them was the figure of the trickster. And there's a book by Lewis Hyde called The Trickster Makes the World. And here again, the notion of the first lie surfaces. There are a couple of examples. Maybe I will give you two right now. And then... And then a quote from Lewis Hyde. So here we have one side, the question of the idea of the necessary lie and its problematics. And then we have the idea of the trickster, who is this, you know, morally ambiguous figure who, he's a border crosser, he's a liar, he makes things up, he gets life going again, and the distinction being very much not about his immorality, but his amorality. And you know, we were, of course, thinking about how this does or does not apply to certain kind of CCF agents, especially in this kind of post-war melancholia of the left. So the two stories. One would be Eshu Alegba, who is a Yoruba trickster figure, god. And he was, there were two friends who were very good friends, and they had farms that were very close to each other and divided by a pathway. And because they hadn't paid their dues to Ashu, Ashu decided to put them to test. And so he sat on a horse and rode across their fields, each field on either side, wearing a hat. And the hat was such that one side of it was white and the other side of it was black. The friends meet later in the evening and are discussing the day, and they were like, did you see that strange figure on a horse? And they fall into a huge fight because one of them insists that the hat was white and the other one insists that the hat was black, such that they... and this, I think, is kind of also related to something that Claire was also suggesting in terms of what you can see and how you can't see it all at the same time, and that these two different versions are just fundamentally incompatible because of where you stand. Anyway, finally, Ashu comes around and they break their friendship, basically, and then he comes around and said... and kind of tells them what had happened. The other story is of Krishna, who is, it's a very well-known story of when he was very young and his mother Yashoda was leaving the house and she was convinced that he was going to steal the buttermilk that was hanging in a pot from the ceiling. And sure enough, and she tells him, don't go for the butter. And sure enough, she comes back home and his face is smeared. His brown face is smeared with this white butter. And he proceeds to give her a list of, answers as to whether or not, the fact that, he thought there were ants, or strange... kind of strange excuses, and then he finally says that, but this is our house. How could I have stolen it? Now I'll just quote from Hyde. The mind-boggling falsity that calls the truth itself into question is what interests Hyde here. Not the simple counterfactual statement, I didn't, when in fact I did. Anyone whose lies merely contradict the truth is still part of a game whose rules have preceded him. He or she merely invents the case, offering not A in place of A. The problem is a lie is to make a lie that cancels the opposition and so holds the possibility of new worlds. And this is where kind of the productive, unambiguous nature of the trickster figure kind of comes into play. To think of, again, the question of lying or concealing the truth or kind of reconfiguring the very basis from which the question of something being true or not is, I think, it's a much longer thing to develop, but is something, again, that perhaps links to some of the discussions we've been having in relation to abstraction and reality. I think I'm going to leave that there for us to kind of come back to when we have our discussion later. And I will move on to introducing Christian and his talk, Encounters with Masks, Counter-Primitivism in the 20th Century, in 20th Century Black Art. I'll begin by just referencing, actually, just to bring this into context also, because there's a lot in the show that somehow deals with this question of primitivism and counter-primitivism, but is maybe not as pronounced. We have it from the discussions Paz was having earlier around Picasso and this very exhibition that happened in 1964 that was organized by the General Secretary of the CCF, Nicholas Nabokov, and it was part of the Berlin Festival, and the exhibition was called The Origins and the Modern, and it was held at the Akademie der Kunst in West Berlin. It presented sculptures from Mexico, Colombia, Peru, Brazil, Congo, Gabon, and Ghana, among others, paired with works by a number of modern artists, including Picasso, Paul Klee, Pollock. The exhibition was a major attempt at integrating the notorious and often explicitly anti-civilizational primitivism of pre-World War II modernists with the new formalist canon. As was noted in a review, what makes origin and modernity real correlates is the break from anecdote and from imitation of nature. The exhibition brought together art from public museums, including the National Gallery, and other museums in Berlin and Paris and New York, MoMA included, private collections, artist studios, and in the case of various African sculptures, attempting to present the experience of artists' travel and the impact of ethnographic collections on modernism. As the curator noted in the exhibition catalog, the desire for origins awoke in the big cities from the desire to shake off the oppressive burden of the past history, the ballast of the museums and the shackles of the academies. Yet, in the same catalogue, Kurt Krager warned, in the context of this exhibition, however, the non-European works of art are shown only in their role as initiators of new European trends and must therefore be viewed from the aesthetic standpoint of the European-American artist. Initially, the exhibition titled Rhythmic Awakening in the 20th Century by Nabokov. The exhibition would place the emphasis on the direct and indirect impulse or stimulus in the widest sense, exercised by the discovery of traditional African art on Western art. There were two different exhibitions that were happening, one that focused on sculptures and then one was kind of dealing with the modern as well. So the primitive and the modern was the second exhibition, and which caused controversy with administrators in Africa who perceived the term primitive as discriminatory, much like other colonial terms such as the dark continent or native. This title triggered an epistolary exchange between Dr. K. Wan from the Legation Council of the German Embassy in Lagos and Nabokov about the term primitive, which provoked ultimately its replacement with the title The Origins and the Modern. So Christian Krawagner, I'm very happy to introduce him. His book, The Transmodern, An Art History of Contact, is going to be launched tomorrow at 6 o'clock at B Books. So that's a little plug. You should go. And one of the things, I'm on the wrong page now. When I heard Christian talk earlier this year and he was speaking about Hale Woodruff and his murals, it really felt like he was an extension of the discussions that we were having. And in his kind of approach to thinking about the African-American position in relation to kind of the question of a global art history and to the question of autonomy, the artist's autonomy. He's an art historian and critic and curator focusing on post-colonialism, migration, art, and politics. He is currently the professor of post-colonial studies at, I'm not going to pronounce it right, in Vienna. And today, on our invitation, is kind of also somehow echoing what we are trying to propose with the title that we have for our conference, actually. So it's kind of bringing together things that are maybe both sublimated and at the fore at the same time. But no, I would like to invite Christian. Thank you.